Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, June 24th of the year 2016. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? We thank all of you, one and all, man, woman, child, young and old, black, white, green, yellow, gray, purple, and orange for joining us on this week's edition of The Arcade. I am Mike the Legend. So glad you can be back with us and that we can be back with you as we close out the month of June. It is hard to believe we are now through the month of June. We have used up 6 months of this 12-month calendar.
That is definitely true. And this week, while I'm also in agreement with you, this week I am also Dennis, the man who is oddly enthralled by this Brexit vote.
Ah, yes, that that vote that is currently being tallied in the in Britain at the time that we are recording this program here on Thursday, June 23rd. Now, by the time you're hearing it, it will most likely have been decided. But
yes,
for us here,
it's currently being tallied. I have the spreadsheet that some nice person from Britain is keeping updated as the polls come in. I keep refreshing it, and it's insanely close.
It's within the thinnest of margins between the exit side and the remain side.
Yes, less than 0.5% at all times. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it go have a wider margin than that. Currently, Leave is winning, but by the end of this program, by the end of us recording this program, that could probably change.
Give it 45 seconds, that will change. It seems to be a matter of it constantly goes back and forth, seesawing between the Remain side and the Leave side. And again, it sounds odd somewhat for us to be talking about this, because by the time you're hearing this program, it will likely have already been decided. The outcome is known, but for us here recording, again, on the evening of Thursday, June 23rd, we don't know. It's unfolding in real time, and the crazy thing is the votes are being tallied, and it's about 4 or 5 in the morning in Britain right now.
Yeah, which is nuts.
I feel sorry for those people.
You would never have stuff like that happening at that late of an hour in North America anywhere, I don't think.
Certainly not. Are they counting these votes by hand individually? Do they not have some sort of Scantron machine?
Yeah, I mean, is there no standards for computerizing a vote of that scale? How do they vote for their elected officials?
Placing stones into a barrel? I don't know. Some sort of
going by weight?
Some sort of old, quaint old-timey method?
Like shaking a duck's hand versus shaking a pig's snout or something?
Placing pigeons in a coop? I don't know. I don't know. I speak with great ignorance on the British electoral system, but yes, we're...
I also speak with great ignorance on the whole, you know, everything that goes into the whole Brexit vote. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've only read in passing, like, you know, with some friends who are in the UK on Facebook, vaguely about, like, you know, a couple who are for, a couple who are against. I don't really know the specifics. I guess I'm just like a stupid foreigner in that regard. I don't really know or get the full gravity of the situation. All I understand is that it could financially impact a lot of different people in a very massive way, is all I understand.
That is one potential outcome, but that remains to be seen how it will all unfold. I don't know. I found myself, anytime there's really any kind of election that goes on, big wide-scale election, I always find myself just glued to my television set, in no small part because I love the technology that the cable channels roll out. It's literally their Super Bowl when they try to show off their, you know, newest, fanciest, snazziest way to really capture the eyeballs of the public who want to know the outcome of whatever's being voted on.
And I think for our past election here in Canada, for the federal election, mm-hmm, where we were voting for our MPs and for Prime Minister, the CBC, I think, won in terms of greatest technology that I saw, at least while watching News World or whatever. It was just, they had like what looked to be, I don't know how they did it, like they had layered in 3D graphics in between people. Mm-hmm. And like they had people just kind of referencing these 3D graphics that were in front of them. And it was like blue screen plus plus, so the way I could describe it.
To a certain extent, virtual overlays of graphics, you know, with motion and everything that are, you know, that is a big new thing in, character generators and broadcast graphics. But what I saw, what really I found neat was I was watching some of the BBC because what else are you going to watch for this?
That's true.
BBC seems to be the standard authority, and, it was a man clearly on a green screen set, but it was a huge green screen set, and he's moving around in three-dimensional space, walking around. There's, you know, virtual graphic overlays behind him. They have, I guess, every county in Great Britain that's voting on this issue, represented just by a vertical line. So it just looked behind him, just like a huge series of lines. So he'd go and like tap one. It would then appear as a virtual overlay of graphic next to the, you know, his shoulder, and it would then go into a bar graph, you know, all sorts of motion and color and title, and there's a lot going on there.
Almost sounds like a far, in some ways, a far less interesting version of Cosmos, but in some ways a just as interesting version of Cosmos, because it's happening related to real-time data and things like that.
It certainly is.
So for data nerds, it's just as impressive as watching Cosmos, I think.
Yes, to a certain extent. And for anyone who's in the field of television production, live broadcast, it's interesting for us on, you know, that respect, just to see what these, you know, networks and what these individuals are doing. And, oh, wow, that's really cool. How can we steal those ideas and appropriate them for, you know, a broadcast of your own? So it's always fascinating. And the fact it's unfolding in live in real time, too.
Yeah. As someone who's like a software developer type person, I wonder what they use as a data source. That's the type of question that goes through my head. Like, part of me has like a strange sinking thought that maybe it's just all being live updated via like a spreadsheet, which might sound crazy, but it might actually be a thing. I mean, having worked with online, tools that use a Google spreadsheet as a data source, for example, I don't think that that would be unreasonable to think that that might be one of the ways that they accomplish these sorts of things.
It's entirely possible. I know in my experience, I've used broadcast character generator programs that have an Excel spreadsheet as a data source. And which that is how all the information is entered and read by the program.
Which is interesting.
You wouldn't think that's a, you know, you would ever use Microsoft Excel for such a purpose. Blew my mind, because I was so accustomed to, for many years, just typing on the actual graphic itself.
Hand-bombing it, as you might call it.
In some ways, yes. And then, oh, I can just load this spreadsheet before? Holy crap. Now, I would not want to do that for the Brexit vote right now and constantly having to live update a spreadsheet. And
oh, no, but like what I mean is, like, if it's powered by a Google Doc or something, that's a live data source that's changing at all times. So I wonder if there's a way, if these tools actually update in real time as well.
I would imagine there is. There would have to be some sort of linking, testing procedure beforehand. This is beyond me.
Yes.
It gets to a certain point where for me, it's all voodoo witchcraft.
Yes. I'm aware of some technologies, you know, for website making that exist that let you do such things, but I don't know how they would tie into big, expensive 3D graphics that are broadcast on the BBC. I'm not sure if they would work that way or if they work in the same way, but, you know, it's interesting to wonder how they do certain things.
It is. And the machines that they use for these broadcast graphics are absolute beasts. They are quite
they would
large.
Have to be.
The RAM involved in them is, yep, that's a lot of RAM. So, more than your high-end gaming PCs.
Oh,
that's
yes.
That's for sure.
Yes. I would imagine these are like probably some of the more expensive Macs probably that you buy or something like that. That have probably in the 64 to 128 gigs of RAM.
Macs.
Maybe more.
I think a lot of the makers are actually their Windows-based systems.
Oh, okay.
But even still, you're right on with the RAM. They're in the 64
huge,
to 128.
Huge amounts
multiple
of RAM.
Multiple terabyte, if not larger size hard drives.
And there's probably multiple of these computers powering these types of systems.
Yep.
If not for as a failover type thing, then possibly for just like pooling the power of multiple machines to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like some Bitcoin mining operations I've seen but for actual graphics and their intended purpose with the graphics cards.
And God, do they throw heat.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
those rooms, probably pretty hot. Probably need dedicated air cooling systems.
Sauna.
Yes.
But we'll, find out more in the, minutes, hours, days, and weeks ahead, the outcome of this Brexit vote. It's, as we update the Google Docs spreadsheet again, the vote percentage has changed. Like, every 10 seconds, it's going to change.
Yeah, every time I refresh, it changes slightly.
And the weird thing is, I've really not seen any party really get more than 51%.
No.
51 point whatever percent.
No, I mean, there was a bit of a wild swing here just as a refresh. Now it went from being, within 0.5. Now it's within it's within almost one now. But yeah, it's still pretty close. Way too close to call.
Is there a margin of error where it's, if it's within 500 votes, they just have to do the whole thing over again? Too close to call?
Could be. But bear in mind, this is currently at almost 16 million votes, so 1% of 16 million is pretty significant. But yeah, I don't know. Very interesting. I have this open, so I'm just going to be refreshing it here and there throughout the show and hopefully not bothering people with the podcast who want to listen to video game news, because we have more E3 to talk about this week.
We sure do. This is a part two of our E3 wrap-up as we close the book on E3 2016, which took place last week at the Los Angeles Convention Center in Los Angeles, California.
California. See,
my brain wanted to say both things, but I can only say one thing at a time. Crowded my mouth. I did not approve. But if you tuned in last week, thank you for tuning in. If you were a first-time listener, thank you for tuning in. We hope you liked what you heard and you're back with us again this week and you took the time to subscribe to us on iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of iTunes and search up The Arcade. We're right there. First result.
Should be. Yep.
Or first or second.
Understand.
Yep. We're double plus awesome that way. Or just to make your life simpler, find the direct link for subscribing on iTunes on our website, thearcadeshow.com. But you heard us last week speak of the big three at E3, Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo. The big news coming out of Sony press conferences, a lot of new games shown off that were really cool looking. Breath of the Wild, the new take on Legend of Zelda, that just is phenomenal.
Yes. One little bit of information I heard about that game since last week, actually. Its map is enormous. Huge.
That's crazy. One thing we spoke of, that the only real detailed information and numbers we had about that and its map size was that it was going to be 12 times larger than the map in Twilight Princess.
Which some people put together and realized that actually, I guess, and also seeing some footage that was, super preliminary footage of just someone scrolling through the map screen and whatnot, they put together that actually means that the map is going to be 6 times larger than that of Skyrim, and almost twice the size of the map in Witcher 3, which is huge.
Which is mind-blowing to me that Nintendo, with a Legend of Zelda game, has a bigger world than Skyrim and Witcher 3.
Yes.
This day has come?
My body is ready.
You're willing to be a vessel and a conduit for this, I see.
Absolutely.
How often do you just go around saying, my body is ready, by the way?
It's an old meme that I haven't brought up in a while, but hey, I figure it's appropriate. I mean, Reggie Fils-Aimé is featured in that meme, and, he works for Nintendo. Link Zelda's a Nintendo game. What can I say?
I approve of this course of action.
Thank you.
That's a massive world.
It's a massive world. It was probably the game winner of E3 this year, for sure.
By many people's counts, yes. And also if you go by the length of lines of people waiting to play it, also the winner in that respect.
Yes.
Largely because the demo and playthroughs on the show floor were much longer, and the game demands a longer playthrough to get a very good idea of what it's offering, unlike, a quick,
Racing
game, or if we think back to the long lines of E3 2006 when the Wii was first shown off and people lost their minds about it.
Yeah.
And the lines were long then, but you were only having a 5-minute playthrough and you got what was being sold. We spoke also last week of Sony really being the console or company winner of the big three, because they brought the most new ideas to the table.
Yeah, tons of games, really stuff that you could actually get your hands on and play in the foreseeable future. Unlike Microsoft, who I think by most accounts seem to be the loser of E3 this year, in terms of the big three companies.
Certainly, and very much relying more on hardware, showing off the very first thing from their presentation being the Xbox One Slim, Xbox One S.
Yes.
Which stands for Slim.
So a new version of the Xbox One, and teasing that there will be a new Xbox coming sometime in the indeterminate future called Project Scorpio.
Sometime in 2017 that has 6 teraflops of computing power.
Yes, while really driving the teraflops idea down people's throats.
Do you know how many teraflops it has?
I think it was 6. Was it 6 teraflops?
It was 6 teraflops. Do you know how many teraflops that is?
6.
That's 1 more than 5, but 1 less than 6, but it's still 1 more teraflop than 5. Amazing!
Yes.
6 teraflops. 1 less than 7,
by the way.
Sorry, I misspoke, but the point remains the same.
Yes. 6 teraflops, because apparently people still care about that as a metric. Teraflops. Bringing it back.
I thought we had kind of moved beyond the era and of, you know, just technology and hardware numbers being, just and specs being the driving force.
Arbitrary specs. Like, ooh, this is a 1.8 gigahertz processor. Ooh! Wow, that's better than 1.7. Holy crap. Like, no one cares about that anymore. Show us what it can do. I mean, the numbers are so big now that it's kind of arbitrary, isn't it?
To a certain extent, and I thought that almost any piece of, you know, half-decent hardware, kit, graphics, motherboard, infrastructure, stuff you're putting into your computer unit is gonna be half-decent now.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of the computer world.
Yeah, I mean, the PC gaming world probably heard that number and scoffed because, well, PCs are usually, like, at least, what, 3 years ahead of consoles anyways, so.
And I believe there's some very high-end graphics cards now which have the same or more computational power than the Project Scorpio and its 6 teraflops.
I would bet that's not a maybe, that's a definite. Or at the very least, by the time Scorpio comes out, it'll already be obsolete. That's just something that we've had to live with for years with consoles. So Why are you selling specs on consoles? Why not sell features? You know, things that people can actually touch, Microsoft. We have this interesting new control scheme that is compatible with whatever. Like, it's not going to be the main thing, but it's an alternative that you could try. Ooh, that'd be neat. Let me try that.
And that sentiment is exactly what Reggie Fils-Aimé shared with when asked by reporters about the NX, its hardware, will it be a direct hardware competition in terms of specs and guts and processing power for Xbox or for Project Scorpio and PlayStation 4 Neo? And he essentially said Nintendo is not about getting into a spec war, spec race. It's about delivering a new kind and fun play experience for the user.
Yeah, just hopefully it's enough to appease developers because, I mean, developers obviously need certain specs to be able to keep relevant in today's modern world.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as it's enough, it should be, you know, enough, right?
You'd think. Oh, and still the current generation of Xbox Ones and PlayStation 4s, developers haven't really pushed them to their limits yet. With the current hardware.
Yeah. Like, by my, you know, admittedly not the youngest eyes, PlayStation 4 and Xbox One games look amazing. They look amazing. Like, there's just pretty much, I can't really imagine how much better games are going to look because they look amazing as is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but it'll look 4K. Well,
yeah. Okay, cool. And I understand that'll require more hardware, but why are you telling me this in a way that's supposed to be surprising me? I'm not surprised by that. It's 4 times the video output. Presumably it needs, I don't know, 4 times the video power, I guess? I mean, that's not crazy to me.
Also, it requires a new television to really...
Well, it requires a 4K TV. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I get it. 4K looks amazing. But, I mean, telling me that it has more teraflops. Like, what? Obviously.
That's not really enough to capture players' imagination. And so that's really one of the big reasons why we said Microsoft didn't have the best E3 showing. But as we spent all of last week's show talking about, again, Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft, we will spend this week's show talking about some of the other big news items to come out of last week in Los Angeles. And we'll start with one of the surprise reveals that happened during Sony's conference that we kind of touched on last week, but we'll get a bit more in depth now this week. They had the surprise reveal of a brand new entry in a long-lived Capcom series, the reveal of Resident Evil 7.
Yes, the Resident Evil 7 reveal, which surprised the hell out of a lot of people, because a lot of us kind of, there's two camps of Resident Evil players. There's the old camp, there's those of us who played the original, you know, three games, thought they were great, you know, really liked the whole survival horror aspect of them, then saw them kind of shift into not a horror franchise anymore, turned into just kind of more like a arcadey action franchise with like horror-ish elements. And then, I mean, you picked up a different type of player at that point, but you kind of lost the original people. And while I don't know what degree of crossover there was, I wasn't as interested in Resident Evil anymore at that point. I mean, I thought 4 was kind of cool, but 5, not really a fan. 6 looked kind of silly to me. But yeah, 7 surprised the hell out of me, this trailer that they released, because a lot of people were drawing comparisons to PT.
Yes, the playable teaser that made a lot of waves really last summer.
Yeah.
Or was it 2 summers ago?
Let's just say, on this, erring on the side of caution, 2 summers ago.
1 to 2 summers ago. Somewhere in there. Because our memories as old men are failing us. Again, yes. Old men.
Old people, memories, bad, etc. So.
Language, not good.
Verbs, nouns, consonants, vowels, language, English, etc.
Aw, man.
Amen. So,
but it's this new take, as you said, it really looks like it's inspired, by a playable teaser, or is reminding a lot of people at the very least by playable teaser, the, you know, game demo that was released by Hideo Kojima, worked on with Guillermo del Toro and Norman Reedus, that was to be the precursor to a new Silent Hills game, as this Resident Evil game is abandoning the balls out action that 4, 5, and 6 really seem to go for, and going back to creepy and unsettling themes and motif.
Yes, going back to being a horror game, primarily focusing on horror, which is good. It's almost like they saw the impact that PT was having, and what more importantly, PT going away was having, seeing how many people were super devastated by the fact that Konami was, well, essentially canning what could have been the next big horror game.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's almost like they looked at themselves and went, holy crap, we have a horror franchise that we kind of could bring back to being a real horror franchise. What are we doing? We could be making so much more money.
Saw the outcry that the demise of PT had online and in people's reaction to it, and saw there realized that there's a vacuum that they could fill with this other franchise used to be like that.
Yes.
And instead got away from it, you know, and had lead characters with completely disproportionate bodies.
Oh yes, Chris Redfield's biceps? Holy crap. Wasn't it bigger than his head in some concept art?
Yes, it was. Yep. So, you know, as much as we may criticize some Japanese character designers for the way they depict females, also, Chris Redfield had to, you know, fulfill someone's fantasy with that design.
Probably. And someone really wanted a nice hug.
Touché. Now, the other... Not only is the surprising news that Resident Evil got announced at the Sony press conference, not only is it surprising that they're going back to the horror, survival horror, genre of the original games, but there's also a release date announced for this game as well.
Yeah, so not only was it dropped on people sort of as like a from out of left field surprise, there's actually there's a tangible time that they can expect it, which is good. It's better than, oh, this thing's coming sometime next year, or, ooh, second quarter 2018. No, there's actually, it's a lot sooner than I would expect, to be honest.
It certainly is. It's pegged for a release in about 7 months' time, January 24th of 2017 for the PlayStation 4. Obviously, that's why it was at the Sony press conference. But in being shown at the Sony press conference, you might think there's some element of exclusivity, console exclusivity, something along those lines.
We all know that basically doesn't exist anymore.
Unless a company is willing to fork out the money. No, it does not.
No.
And Sony, not willing to fork out the money, so instead it's coming out on the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC.
Well, the Xbox One and PC versions didn't have quite as confirmed a date. All they said for those versions was soon.
Indeed, but it's starting to release on January 24th, 2017. And not only that, also announced to be coming out for the, or a build of it, coming out for the PlayStation VR.
Yeah, I think that might be one of the more interesting aspects to this, because if you watch the trailer, which you can find a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com, it looked pretty interesting visually, offering what they were calling photorealistic visuals, as well as, you know, very horrifying imagery at times and just really unsettling stuff. I think putting VR in there is a good way to get the shit scared out of you, which might be what a lot of people have been waiting for. I mean, to be honest, one of my most memorable gaming experiences I had growing up was when I first played Silent Hill. I played it, I guess I was working nights at the time, and, you know, on my days off, you know, when you're working nights, you can't really sleep regular hours on your days off, or else you'll screw your whole sleep schedule up. So on my days off, I would just be kind of like, you know, wouldn't be uncommon for me to just be playing video games, you know, in my parents' basement or whatever, like in, you know, darkness in 3 a.m., you know, with headphones on. And that's how I stupidly played Silent Hill in the dark with headphones on.
That's a bad idea.
But it was so great and terrifying because there was a lot of weird audio elements that kind of added to the immersion. Like I would just be going through, and because, you know, they normally were pretty good about like stereo wise where enemies were coming from. Like you'd hear like something crackling on the left and you go look to the left and oh, there's something over there. But I remember there was just weird, creepy things that were in the game as well. At one point in time, I remember walking into a room and I hear super loud glass shattering just in the left speaker. And I go, what the hell is that? Nothing. Oh, cool. So I would imagine if you have that coupled with VR, holy crap.
That is going to be a terrifying experience.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't even think playing the old games would be enough to prepare you for that.
No, nothing could prepare you for that. What possibly do we have as a analog to this for, like, such a weird immersion opportunity? People might get PTSD from this damn thing. We don't even know what effects this might have.
Oh, there could be some shell shock going on, certainly. And we'll see how it all plays out. We'll see how long people are able to play for it, and if I really think pacing is going to have to be taken into account for this build of Resident Evil 7.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly, if you go with a scare-a-minute jump scares, that might actually kill someone.
It might give someone a heart attack.
I mean, There's part of us that are exaggerating and carrying on, but another part where that could actually happen. The experience is so immersive, given that you have the VR headset, the image right there, inches away from your eyeballs. You're wearing headphones. You are really cut off and have no sense of your surroundings, that you are believing that you are in this world, and in this world of Resident Evil 7, you're not in Raccoon City. You're not anything really to do with Raccoon City. You are in the American South. You are on an old plantation in the bayou somewhere, perhaps Louisiana, Alabama, but an old plantation house where bad things have happened.
Yes.
Also, it's a plantation house.
We've all seen Django Unchained, right?
Just bad things happen in general there before you add the layer of Resident Evil to it.
Yep. So that's a thing.
Also, one thing I think that we both want to make note of and pass along our kudos and congratulations to the graphic designer over at Capcom or whatever other agency who came up with the word mark.
Oh, yes. Because as we all know, well, maybe we don't all know, maybe there's some of you who aren't aware, Resident Evil is only Resident Evil in North America. Elsewhere, it's Biohazard. It's just one of those weird naming things where they weren't allowed to call it Biohazard over here for whatever reason. But they weren't able to call it Biohazard, so elsewhere in the world it's known as Biohazard, whereas here it's known as Resident Evil. They were really brilliant in how they did both the Biohazard and Resident Evil word marking, as you said, for the logos for this title in both here and elsewhere, because they managed to work a 7 brilliantly into both logos. I mean,
In different methods,
but using the same type of method. So the same type of imagery where you just see, as part of the word Resident Evil, you see VII, you know, for the VI and then the first part of the L at the very end, you see like the Roman numeral 7 in just red, which is kind of cool.
No, orange.
Orange, sorry, yes. But then in the Biohazard, they work the number 7 in the top part of the Z. In the same, exact same color of orange. Mm-hmm. And so it works in both versions, which I thought was neat, you know, from like just a graphics kind of point of view.
Mm-hmm. And being in on the top half of the Z, really missing, I guess, the tail of the Z to form the 7, the shape of the number 7, it's actually ends up being basically the middle of the word mark.
Yeah.
So it draws your attention right away, it being orange compared to the letters around it being white.
Yep.
Just absolutely genius idea.
Yeah, I thought so.
Really clever. And so kudos to that individual. Also, if you're interested, Capcom did also announce a pre-order bonus. If you're thinking of picking up Resident Evil 7, you will get the Survival Pack if you pre-order the game. That will grant you the ability to unlock the game's hardest difficulty. Now, Resident Evil games have never really been a cakewalk.
No, I wouldn't say so.
So, this will have the hardest difficulty unlocked immediately for you. God only knows what that entails. If you do not pre-order the game, there's no word yet on how you'll be able to get the hardest difficulty, but you may have to finish the game on increasingly harder and harder difficulties.
Yeah.
Or if you're just an absolute masochist, pay for it now. You're one of those sickos.
You're one of those people that have that thing wrong with them. You know, the thing. But yes.
But speaking of the lucky number 7, there was another 7th game announced during E3. This one, one of the first surprises of E3, it came during Microsoft's conference on Monday morning. I guess the pre-show event on Monday morning.
You're saying it was a surprise because it happened during Microsoft's conference? Or a surprise that this franchise is getting another game?
Both? And also a surprise of what the trailer for this game showed off.
Yeah.
So 3 levels of surprises for this, the 7th entry, 777, Lucky 7, 7 times 3 is 21, 2 plus 1 is 3, oh my god, numerology.
All right,
Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.
We have the purity of essence.
Oh my god, there's 3 letters in POE, purity of essence, peace on earth.
We have broken Michael Legend's brain.
Oh my god, I need quarters from a Coca-Cola machine. I have to call someone. I have to call someone right now.
Oh my god.
General Turgeson.
Dimitri. Anyways, yes.
Maybe we should include our younger listeners. If you don't get the reference of what we just were speaking about and referencing there, that one, God! But two, you'll want to watch the movie Doctor Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. One of the great classic anti-war movies. Also, well, Stanley Kubrick movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's not many of those, but they're all pretty much classics.
Early Stanley Kubrick,
yeah, too. Early Stanley Kubrick. Black and white. Brilliant movie.
Dark comedy.
Super dark comedy. Still hilarious, but really dark.
And one of the finest acting performances you'll ever see in a movie.
Oh, yeah.
With one actor playing three different roles.
Yes, the comic genius that is Peter Sellers.
Yes, and it would have been four roles, but he was ill during the days when they had to film him being the bomber pilot.
Yes, so instead they got Slim Pickens. Absolutely brilliant. Slim Pickens. I love Slim Pickens.
And James Earl Jones is in the movie.
He's really young.
And George C. Scott.
Yeah, lots of classic people in that movie.
I have to watch that movie again.
Yes.
Anyway.
But anyways, yes. This other seventh game in a long-standing franchise we're talking about is Tekken.
You know, Tekken, the classic fighting series that has long been a staple of Sony platforms?
Yes.
Well, apparently it's spreading the wealth Bandai Namco is with the Tekken franchise, as it's going to be coming out not only to the PlayStation 4, but also to the Xbox One, as it was shown off, as I said, during the Microsoft conference. It's slated for an early 27 release date, given that this is a new game announcement. A nebulous release window is acceptable, at least in my mind.
Yeah.
And that's fine. The surprise is enough that the game has been announced to be in development. It's also going to come out to the PC via Steam, but the big surprise really is not that they're making seventh game. It's shown itself to be a very successful franchise, both commercially and critically. Thus, understandably, they would make another game. Bandai Namco would. But the surprise coming from the character shown in the initial trailer for it.
Yes, not the first one you see, because that's Heihachi, and, well, obviously you expect him to be in a Tekken game. He's been in every single Tekken game.
He is the Ryu of...
Yeah, he's the face of Tekken, pretty
exactly.
much.
Exactly. Ryu, Ken, Guile, one of those mainstay characters of a Tekken fighting game.
But we ended up seeing second was someone I don't think anyone was really expecting to see in a Tekken game.
No, because that character appeared and was Akuma.
Yes, you know, the classic hidden initially and now then later sort of eponymous character for Street Fighter.
Kind of just a staple of Street Fighter games after he was initially unlocked, and then was he a boss character?
I think he was. He was like a M. Bison type, mythic type character, but yeah, he's still like, he's known as one of the Street Fighter characters, like, most people that know Street Fighter know Akuma.
Yes, he is one of those recognizable faces from the Street Fighter world, but he is going to cross over into the realm of Tekken 7, and the trailer that was shown off shows Akuma battling Heihachi, and it hints at, in the dialogue and direction of the trailer, that the two of them have a past, and they're coming to settle something.
Yes. Apparently, including Akuma was... Well, he was talking about how he's fulfilling a promise to Kazumi Mishima, which, I don't really know a lot about Tekken's mythology, so there's probably some significance there, but him and Heihachi probably have ties to one another in that, over that character.
I'd assume they've fought previously in some sort of past life, or maybe previous tournament.
Maybe won someone's father or something, or maybe it's like a brother or something. I don't know.
Akuma owes him $50.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Heihachi gives him $2 change.
Heihachi's name is Heihachi Mishima. Akuma said he had a promise to Kazumi Mishima. Maybe it was like, maybe a daughter or something? I don't know. Who knows?
I don't know. I will admit I do not follow the Tekken franchise that closely. Ultimately, all fighting games I don't follow that closely because I'm very bad at fighting games. I will fully acknowledge and admit that. I have no compunctions about sharing that with the world. So that was certainly a surprise. And given that, you know, we've long waited for and at this point do not expect to see a Tekken cross Street Fighter game.
Yeah.
Since Bandai Namco, I think, has been clear that it's kind of on the back burner and it just may be something that they never get around to.
Yeah.
Which is very disappointing.
Yeah. So maybe this is their way of trying to sort of make it up to Street Fighter fans?
Maybe. And perhaps there will be a few other Street Fighter characters who cross over to the tech world.
Throwing them in for no reason. Oh, look, let's fight Ken. Woo! Oh, there's Chun-Li. Hey! Oh, no, who's that green guy? Oh, it's Blanka. Oh, no.
Oh, my God, DJ, what are you doing here? T-Hawk?
Just pull out all, like, the racist characters and all the... Oh, Rog. Were you boxing up a storm? It's like, oh God.
Just yes.
Ham-fisted writing. Just awful.
That could also happen. I hope not, but, maybe there will be a few others thrown in there just to be a make good for the Tekken Cross Street Fighter game that we'll never get.
Yeah.
Or have no confidence we'll ever get. But another game that surprised a lot of people when it was announced at E3 last week was the standalone card game or standalone version of the very popular card game Gwent.
Yes, if those of you who have played Witcher 3, I should say, would know that they'd replaced that whole like dice game that they had in the previous game with a fully fleshed out card game called Gwent. I really enjoyed playing Gwent. I found myself kind of not really losing interest in the story, but kind of going out of my way to just try to battle as many people as I could in Gwent. And I just found myself being unable to stop playing Gwent. I like to say Gwent too, by the way.
I'm noticing that. So if you're following along and having your weekly arcade drinking game, take a shot every time Dennis says Gwent.
Yes. Feel free and go back and really like double it up if you want. If you want to get hammered really fast, I'll just say Gwent, 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 Gwent. And Gwent, and hopefully you don't have to go to the hospital. I'm sorry, I'll probably have to say Gwent a couple more times, like then, and throw talking about this, but yes.
Because you're talking about Gwent.
I'm talking about Gwent, because Gwent is getting a standalone game. Hey, by the way, I already signed up for the pre-release beta, and...
I'm not surprised.
Said I'm in. So, sometime in September, I believe, is when the date said.
It's true. It's coming out on Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and PC. You can go and try and sign up for the beta at playgwent.com. We have a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com. And this was announced by a developer from CD Projekt Red on the stage during the Microsoft show. And even the developer himself, whose name escapes me at the moment, acknowledged that CD Projekt Red and the whole team put so many thousands of hours into building this huge world that you could play in, so many different quests you could do, so many different characters, stories, just elements to the game to make it a big, all-encompassing world, and so many players, like you, as I point at Dennis, really just took to playing Gwent.
Yeah, what can I say? It was really fun.
Just this huge world, and like, let's ignore it. I'm just going to play my card game here.
I didn't ignore the huge world, but I feel like having, like, a game like Gwent in there really kind of spiced things up, because it was like the world's poker or something, where everyone had their own card. It was kind of weird in some ways, where players would have their own cards and stuff, but it was kind of interesting. I mean, I've played a lot of these types of games where they try to put a weird side game in and it just doesn't work because either the game's not very good or it's not believable that it would be in this world. Whereas this is like a medieval type world.
Blitzball.
Yeah, Blitzball or
Blitzball's just hard to play.
Yeah, or like the one I'm thinking of is Caravan in Fallout 3, Fallout New Vegas, I should say. It's like a weird. I could never get the hang of that game. I never understood how it worked. I know there's like a lot of complaints that people had about Caravan. Very strange game. Do not like. I think probably up to this point, like the best card side game I think would have been Triple Triad in Final Fantasy VIII. But even still, it was like a little bit of a limited kind of game. Whereas Gwent, there's like strategies that you could use to try to play. But I guess one of the big downsides of Gwent I always found was that I'm always playing against computer opponents and AI can only be so smart, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if Gwent is actually like an online experience where you could play with other people, it could be quite challenging, I think.
Certainly, because everyone is going to bring their own unique strategy to the game that they will have developed and formulated through their own playthroughs of Gwent in Witcher 3, but this standalone version of Gwent, it's also going to have an apparently, quote, monumental single-player campaign. So it's not only just the multiplayer card game aspect, competing online with your deck or your cards, whatever the case may be, but instead you're playing a full player, single-player campaign, no doubt to acquire new cards for your deck and then see how that affects your game. But
yeah,
this is a thing. Gwent. Yes.
According to the email that I got actually about signing up for the closed beta, they say that they plan on launching the closed beta in September 2016.
Ah.
So I don't know whether or not that, how long the closed beta is going to go on for or when the actual release is going to be, but that's, the email says the closed beta is in September 2016. So if you haven't signed up for the closed beta and you're interested, try to sign up for the closed beta. Should be a good time, I think.
Certainly. I think this is going to be one of the surprise hits of the year.
Interestingly, I saw another interview video with the developer, again, whose name escaped me, responsible, who's like the lead developer for Gwent. And apparently Gwent was not even going to make it into Witcher 3.
Really?
Unless, like, it was a last minute thing where he was trying to really push for it and they were just going to do dice poker again. But he apparently stayed, like, worked all weekend. Him and one or two other people worked all weekend just to get, like, a functioning demo going of this game. Just to prove, like, that it could be done and that it actually, there are, you know, could be a fun game to play. And he worked all weekend on it and finally convinced people. And then they had to put in a bunch of overtime just to get it working. So I'm glad it's paying off for them because, yeah, it was a fun game.
Could its popularity or the popularity of Gwent, the card game from Witcher 3, also be contributed to because card games themselves now are very popular?
It's possible. Like either collectible card games like Magic the Gathering or even just deck building type games like Dominion or like Thunderstone or whatnot.
Or even just casual card games, even something like Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah. I mean, it's very possible. We are seeing a revival of tabletop games.
We certainly are. And that may be part of it now, where it tapped into something that is very popular at the moment, and people just took to it, and it took off like wildfire. But so that we'll figure out the full release date as time goes on, and of course get full reports from Dennis in a couple months once he plays through the release.
Absolutely.
The beta release.
The beta release, yes.
Yes, not the full release. He's not getting it before anyone else. He's not that special.
No.
So, sorry, spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. I understand.
but speaking of games that can take off like wildfire, one that really took off like wildfire on Steam when it was released just earlier this year is a little game that falls under the heading of Little Game That Could and Stardew Valley. The little game that was done by, I believe, one guy.
Yeah, it's another one of those. I mean, there's a few of them that were pretty popular over the last few years, like Undertale and, you know, games like that. But Stardew Valley was one of them as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of Harvest Moon-ish game released on Steam for your PC and whatnot. But we're talking about it because during E3 last week, I mean, it was shown off as part of a montage for the indie games portion of the Microsoft press conference. And that got people wondering, huh, what? But that's a PC. And then it was later that day on the official blog for the game that it was announced that, yes, Stardew Valley is coming to all consoles.
Yes.
So it will be releasing sometime later this year. There's no release date, but yeah, there's...
The window is Q4 2016, which is sometime between October and December.
And it's going to come out, as we know and understand, on the Xbox One, obviously then the PlayStation 4, and the Wii U as well. The Nintendo console is getting a small indie game.
Yeah.
A third-party published game. Huh.
Yeah. And as the developer said in the blog, in his blog post on his website, and I quote, "It's very important to me that playing Stardew Valley with console controllers is intuitive and effortless. I'll be the first to admit that the current rudimentary controller support in the PC version is far from ideal, and it will need to be adjusted prior to the launch. I'm excited about the possibility of utilizing special console features like the Wii U's second screen." So that should be interesting. I mean, I understand that this developer, he's pretty responsive to fan, like, when they find bugs and stuff too, so.
Yeah, fan interaction, feedback and whatnot. So he's actually built up a lot of goodwill in the PC gaming community for his ability to respond, communicate, take criticism well. If people, you know, will give him kudos and compliments, and he'll be gracious about it online. And even, as you mentioned, yeah, he'll, people on, say, Twitter will point out and have pointed out bugs in the game. Maybe something's not quite right. Because it's a one-person developed game, he's also the tech support.
Yeah, I guess he would have to be, unless he suddenly makes a ton of money and can hire a bunch of people, but...
It may be that's the case, or maybe not quite yet, but I have seen it pointed out in various articles I've read online that users on Twitter have taken to pointing out, say, hey, you know, this section of the game is, this very specific part of the game isn't quite, you know, functioning properly. He'll then acknowledge, say, okay, yep, cool, noted, got a, you know,
putting it in the backlog.
Yeah, putting in the backlog, can't really tackle it tonight, been up for like 18 hours coding, I'll look at it tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Cool. And just that, I guess, ability to interact and come across just as a normal person. He is ultimately just a guy who did this as a passion project, it seems, and it's really taken off and still is coming across as just a guy.
Yeah, and that's cool. I mean, hopefully he can stay humble if his game hits it super big and he starts making mega console cash.
Who knows?
I don't know what console cash looks like. Maybe it's not that much. I'm not sure. But
even if he doesn't, I'm sure he can still be okay with the Steam cash.
Yes.
And maybe it will be spun out into, you know, merchandise, toys, clothing line, lunchboxes, and maybe its own television show.
Maybe it'll be the next Minecraft. Maybe Microsoft will pay him $2.5 billion to acquire the intellectual property and him, and then he can quit and then just like go live in a mansion somewhere.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. That he bought off of Jay-Z.
No, outbid Jay-Z.
Oh, outbid Jay-Z. That's what it was, right?
Yes, he paid like $80 million for the house. Yes. Bought it fully furnished.
We're, of course, speaking of Notch, who, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways,
Who never his grandkids never have to work.
Yeah. Maybe their grandkids even.
Probably. I think it'd be interesting to see an actuary kind of chart out if, expenditures just remain kind of normal and average for whatever a person's livelihood, say middle class or upper middle class, to maintain that kind of lifestyle, how many generations could a billionaire's heirs survive off the original billionaire's funds? 7, 8, 9 generations?
Could be a video game itself.
Ooh, yes.
Call it Notchcraft. Anyways.
Terrible. But we'll move on and turn some attention now to Ubisoft, who are publishing the forthcoming South Park game, The Fractured Butthole, which was revealed at last year's E3. Just the fact that it was in development surprised a lot of people, since nobody knew it was in development.
Yeah, and I'm pretty glad that Trey Parker and Matt Stone are back on making video games, because all it took was one actually good game to get them back on board. Because, you know, for the longest time, it seems like they were pretty reluctant to do anything like that with South Park because of that whole slew of really crappy games from the 90s.
Chef's Love Shack, South Park 64.
Yeah, that racing one.
I think there was a car.
South Park Racing or something.
Yeah, just they washed their hands of it and let other people do the video game stuff with the property, and they're like, whatever. But now they are interested in making video games.
Yeah, it seems like as the years went on and they kind of came out of their drug hazes and got more protective of South Park, they really wanted to actually like maintain a level of quality amongst everything, which is good. But also it visibly looks like it's burned Trey Parker the hell out. If you look at them these days, he looks like he's a little bit older now.
Well, they have been doing the show for 20 years.
It's true.
And probably the pace they kept doing the show at, especially for the first, 15 years, we're doing 10, 12, 15, 20 episodes a year. That is just going to wear on you.
Oh, yeah.
But now they've pared it down to 10 in a row, and they can survive and then go off and be normal people outside those 10 weeks.
Yeah, and do critically acclaimed musicals and stuff as well.
and make fantastic video games. So, which we saw with South Park: The Stick of Truth, which came out 2 years ago in 2014.
Yeah, fantastic game if you haven't played it.
For the most part, the fart mechanics still just I can't. No,
that was all right.
I never liked it. It seemed no, but nevertheless, it did feel like you were in the world and the town of South Park, and you got to explore it and see people's houses and whatnot. And so, the surprise coming last year, that Fractured But Whole was in development, and this year's E3 allowed us to see a bit more of the game and some new dynamics and just really what the story is behind the Fractured But Whole. There was a new trailer shown off that explains kind of the motivations of the South Park kids and what they're up to this time and why they're all fighting again.
Yeah, so I guess the premise this time is that they're all their superhero characters. You know, you have Cartman as the Coon, you have Kenny as Mysterion, you have spoiler if you weren't aware of that, but whatever. But you have, like, you know, various other kids as their whatever characters, and then it's basically Cartman's going through talking about how they want to monetize their superheroes and talk about the movie plan and how he gets a movie and whoever gets a movie and he gets another movie. And like, they have a three-phase thing, kind of obviously making fun of the Marvel Cinematic Universe's approach to all of their different movies that they've had, where eventually they're all kind of coming together and intertwining and stuff. But, you know, then there's complaints about, you know, why certain characters don't get their own movies and why he gets so many movies and why Token doesn't get a movie till the third phase because he's the black kid and stuff like that. And then it causes a bunch of infighting. And then one kid says, you know, makes a comment like, you want a civil war? Yeah, I want a civil war. All right, civil war. And then it's just basically, that's the whole premise of the game. So you're on whatever side.
One of them, I'd assume you have an opportunity in the game to choose which faction you align with.
You kind of do in the Stick of Truth as well.
True, you do. And much like Stick of Truth, in that game, you can pick your fighting class. In this game, you can pick your superhero class. Although there's a lot more classes of superhero than there were, you know, fighting classes in Stick of Truth.
Yeah, whereas Stick of Truth was sort of just based on the classic D&D tropes or the classic fantasy tropes of, like, you know, the fighter, the wizard, whatever else.
Archer and Jew.
Yeah, which... Classic South Park. Classic South Park. But this one, well, we can't really talk about it on the program, but the giving your character your backstory was hilarious, by the way. Hilarious. And just the fact that Kyle points out how stupid the backstory is to Cartman, the whole scene was hilarious. And we have a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com.
And it's profane. Warning, language. Totally not safe for work.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's South Park. I mean, you must have seen at least some South Park before. You know what it's like, hopefully. If not, well, maybe it might be a good introduction for you. If not, maybe it's not your thing. Hopefully it's your thing. It should be your thing. Come on. How can South Park not be your thing?
You're a monster?
Right?
I'd assume that's the only way. But, so new gameplay mechanics were shown off. The fact that space now plays an aspect in battles, so you can move around a bit.
Yeah, sort of XCOM-ish looking.
Yeah, move your characters around. Time apparently is manipulated through farts. And they also showed off a new trailer, which at the end gave the release date, which is December 6th of 2016. So it's coming out in just a couple months' time.
6 months' time, roughly.
Less than that, my friend.
Well, roughly.
Sure. Ish? Ish. Yeah. We'll go with ish. So that's very awesome to look forward to, coming out on the Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and PC. Actually, a really cool pre-order bonus they also announced, too, on stage at the E3, or Ubisoft E3 show, that if you pre-order South Park Fractured But Whole, you also get a copy of Stick of Truth right away, available to download right then, for your Xbox One, PlayStation 4, or PC.
Yep, for free.
For free. So you're getting two games for the price of one.
Yep.
Which is awesome. So that's actually something to really look forward to. And also, Towly is like your gaming buddy or something. You got something to do with Towly.
Of course. But, yeah.
And December 6th also got another release date announcement. Capcom, in a separate announcement on Monday of E3, announcing that Dead Rising 4 in development and also coming this holiday season.
Yes, the same date as South Park: Stick of Truth, December 6th.
Indeed.
Big release date for a couple of games, anyways.
It is. That's kind of like the last little blast to do your shopping before Christmas. Although, really, if you've waited that long, you're hooped. Absolutely hooped. although, that's still too early for someone like you to do your shopping.
It's true. I've definitely cut it that close several times in the past.
Whereas I will be, at home, sipping my hot cocoa, enjoying the warmth of the lights on my Christmas tree, with a giant smirk on my face, knowing you're out there sweating because you haven't done your Christmas shopping. Well, whereas I will have been done for 3 months by that point, and that's just how I roll.
That'll pretty much work out. It'll be fine. It's worked out several times in the past.
You're playing fast and loose.
What can I say? It's the only way to play. I live for the thrill.
Adrenaline junkie. But appropriate, I have to say, that Dead Rising 4 is coming out on December 6th, so close to Christmas, right in the midst of the holiday shopping season, as Dead Rising 4 itself is set with Frank West returning to Willamette, Colorado, visiting a mall during the Christmas season, which is then invaded by zombies, and he has to fight them off. Very similar idea to the first game, just with Christmas added to it.
Yes.
And all the various Christmas displays and ornamentation you'll get from a mall being done up for Christmas. Not just a mall, an American shopping mall.
Yes, so think of the Mall of America. Never been there? It's huge.
Surprise.
Yeah. It's enormous. It's like 5 stories high. Has many wings. It's very easy to get lost in.
It never ends.
Yeah, it's just there's like 4 food courts spread out throughout it, I think.
A huge number of restaurants, a theme park inside. Really, if you wanted to, you could live there and no one would know.
Probably.
I mean, you have enough store options in between, like, a mattress store, a clothing store, the food courts. I believe there's a gym in there as well, so you can go shower. So really, you never have to leave.
Yeah, yeah. Good times.
So Dead Rising 4 also on December 6th, which we learned at E3. But E3 was also the time when Ubisoft, going back to them for a moment, showed off two new games that really got a lot of people interested. The first one, they kind of showed off before, really the weekend before E3 in, I believe it was an interview, a preview article done with the USA Today. And also it was through there that they released the reveal trailer for Star Trek Bridge Crew, their new Star Trek-centric game coming to virtual reality.
Yes, for Vive, Rift, and PlayStation VR. Looked pretty cool. I mean, the trailer we saw had LeVar, like, various alumni from various Star Trek properties, like 4 alumni from various properties getting together to play the game together, and they were they looked like they were kind of blown away. It was kind of, the trailer seemed to be headed up by LeVar Burton, who apparently knew the lingo the best out of all of them because, well, he was on the show for 7 years, whereas like the other people that were there maybe were only on a couple movies or not as many seasons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he really hyped it up quite a bit. And I mean, LeVar Burton is kind of known to, well, I trust his opinion. Maybe I shouldn't, because maybe my opinion of LeVar Burton skewed because he was such a huge part of most of our childhoods, and he just seems to be one of those trustworthy guys that we can rely on for consistent good information, but...
Hey, did he ever recommend a bad book?
I don't know. I don't think so. But you don't have to take my word for it.
I feel like we should have just interjected the sound effect right then.
We should have, but I couldn't find it. I also didn't look for it.
So that's why you couldn't find it.
It's true. You can't find things that you don't look for.
It's true. But Star Trek...
Words to live by.
That is t-shirt material.
Yes.
Star Trek Bridge Crew, placing you in one of 4 positions on the ship of the USS Aegis, a fancy new ship that is apparently or might be the jewel of the Starfleet fleet of ships.
Yes, if you ignore the fact that the Enterprise is the jewel of the Starfleet fleet of ships.
Maybe something's happened to the Enterprise in this. I don't know.
Sure, let's go with that. Convenient excuse.
Yes, you're on a ship that's not the Enterprise, even though
it's pretty much the Enterprise.
Maybe you get to be on the Enterprise later, but you get to command or play from one of four stations.
You get to parlay with Kirk, because it does take place seemingly during the original series.
It does, but the art style makes it look like it's set in the kind of J.J. Abrams reboot movie era.
Yeah.
So, different canon? Maybe. Maybe you're playing in the era before, the, you know, who knows? Who knows? But you get to play in, you know, command. You can be captain of the, you know, ship. That's not the Enterprise. You can be in engineering, tactical, the helm. And the reveal trailer showed off that it's a multiplayer game, but which then means, sweet God, it's going to be expensive to play it as a multiplayer VR game.
Yeah, if you want to play with all four people, I mean, first of all four people have to be in the same space. Because apparently it works best when you're just talking to people and being like, hey, helm, full impulse out of here. We got to get out of this battle. Or, oh, hey, tactical, shields up. Or like, you know, whatever, like maneuver us out of here, helm. Like, but yeah, if you kind of factor the costs of VR helmets being what? Like they're going to be what?
$500-$600
bucks each. Plus like there's hand controls that look like you have to buy for each one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably another $100. So that's
a each.
Good, yeah, each. So four people times what? $700. Seven times four. That's like $2,800 right there. Plus a capable computer to run it.
Which is
another probably grand plus.
I'd say grand. I think grand's a good number. So really.
Plus the game, which is going to be another probably $60.
It's the cheapest part of the equation. Cheapest
part of the equation. But to play this game, it's probably going to cost you a good, like, what, $4,000 to play it?
Yeah, for that authentic Star Trek multiplayer VR experience, $4,000. It's really not a game. It's not an experience. It's an investment.
Yes.
That's the way you have to look at it. I mean, it looks neat, but then again, it's from the footage we saw of, you know, people when they're in-game doing their duties on the bridge of this not-Enterprise ship. It's first person perspective, and all you really have are your character's hands coming forward and you're pressing buttons.
Yes. So
that is not the most enthralling game experience for me.
Not really.
That makes it like a point and click adventure in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, I'd like to try it, but I don't want to spend $4,000 to try it.
Oh, come now.
What, do you?
Well, no.
Oh, but... come now.
Damn it! I was hoping to browbeat you into it.
Well, not today.
You've certainly wisened up to my ways.
Indeed.
But that's not the only new game Ubisoft showed off. They also revealed a really interesting new title called Steep.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
It's not about tea.
No. It is about mountains, though. I mean, you know how some mountains can be steep?
Yes.
It's not just about mountains, though. It's about what you can do on a mountain. And no, get your mind out of the gutter. It's about what... It's about what, you know, people who like to ski and do extreme type sporty things might do on, you know, mountains.
Extreme type sporty things.
Yes.
Spoken like a true man who does not sport.
Indeed.
I believe the proper term is action sports.
Sure, action sports.
Such things as downhill skiing, snowboarding, paragliding, wingsuiting, cause-
Yes, because people are insane.
Apparently just everyday life does not hold enough excitement for some people in our society, so they have to jazz it up a little.
The only way they can feel feelings is by flying down the side of a mountain at 500 miles an hour, with no protection around them.
They're wearing a helmet. They're not completely crazy.
I mean, to quote the John Candy character from Cool Runnings, when you're going that fast, bones don't break. They shatter. So, I mean, the footage actually shows like your characters crashing and stuff too, and you hear real bone crunches and screaming, and it's kind of hilarious in a dark way, knowing that, you know, these virtual characters are doing this and putting their bodies through such extreme, you know, trauma and whatnot, mm-hmm. just for the thrill. But I have to say the trailer did look pretty impressive.
It certainly did. The idea is that it's an open world action sports game where you can go to different locales, different countries. I believe Italy, Austria, France, probably Switzerland are going to be there as well. Go to different mountain ranges. And
you get to just drop in. There's drop points mm-hmm. on these mountain ranges where you just kind of end up, and then you can kind of just go from there.
You select what you want to do, downhill ski, snowboard, as I said, paraglide, or wingsuit, which if you don't know what a wingsuit is, think Rocky the Flying Squirrel from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
That. It's that. But a human in a suit.
Yeah, there's wingsuit races that you can partake in, because it looks like it's also a multiplayer game.
It does, yes.
And I can't actually imagine a real human doing that in real life, but if people do, holy crap.
Oh, they do. I assure you. They do. And it's actually not terribly surprising that this game is in development now. Extreme sports like this, you know, back, you know, in 20 years ago now, roughly, is when we really first saw the X Games come to prominence with their broadcasts on ESPN. So they've had 20 years to just become an ingrained part of our sporting landscape, our culture now, and combine that with the rise and the popularity of sport cameras such as GoPros and whatnot, and people strapping themselves as they go skateboarding, downhill skiing onto their helmets, on their chest, and then sharing that online or through social media with their friends, that's actually taken these action sport events to a new level of popularity. And actually, the ability to kind of record and share awesome tricks or awesome crashes with your friends in the game is going to be a major component.
And interestingly enough, there's brilliant, brilliant marketing tie-in with GoPro for this game as well. Because GoPro is really the company that sort of reinvigorated in many ways the whole extreme sports with how durable their cameras are and how, you know, they have all the different like head mounts and stuff.
And offering a new perspective.
Yeah, like you get to actually see from the person doing its perspective of some of these insane things. Like we also saw the GoPro, for example, the GoPro footage of Felix Baumgartner when he was doing his like jump from the top of the atmosphere down to Earth.
Yes.
I mean, it was kind of at points unwatchable footage because it was just like spinning out of control, but
also he was spinning out of control.
Yeah, which is crazy, but we got to sort of experience that from his point of view, things like that. Just the GoPro camera has kind of brought us that. I'm sure most of us have seen that video online that actually, like, I don't want to sound like I'm selling GoPro cameras. I have no idea how good they actually are or not. But we saw that footage online of the person who was skydiving. The camera broke off their helmet or fell off their helmet and then hit the ground, and it was still fine, which is kind of impressive. Mm-hmm. So,
and GoPro itself as a company is a major sponsor of action sports events.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that they'd want to have a partnership with Ubisoft for a game like this.
It's just very interesting that we see, like, these characters with GoPros on their head. Like, it never clicked with me that that would have been a thing that we would have saw in a video game, but of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we have that level of realism now, and one of the interesting looking things, I don't know if it's actual, like, if it was just trickery magic that they did for the trailer or not, but it looks like you can kind of switch between different views, including the GoPro view, should that be what you want to kind of watch if you're kind of doing some of these events. Though I feel like doing wingsuiting from that view might be a little bit scary as hell, or disorienting at the very least. So
certainly you'd want to check it out. How long you wish to maintain that view is entirely up to you and your ability to withstand being nauseatingly close to a mountainside as you're going way too goddamn fast, sneering at the laws of physics and gravity.
Yep.
And just defying God's will like that.
Indeed.
He did not intend man to fly like that. How dare you? But it's actually a really neat idea. I believe also I saw some characters with Red Bull helmets, because Red Bull is also
a major sponsor, of course,
of these things, so it would make sense if there's a tie in there.
Hey,
so give it another element of realism.
An interesting way to actually fund the development of your game, too, I think.
It's a logical tie-in.
Yeah.
It's not as, you know, garish as having, oh, just all of a sudden a Burger King appear.
Yeah, like what?
In the Swiss Alps. Like, oh, we're just going to go get a Burger King now.
Going to get a Whopper. Got to fuel up. Like, pretty sure no one's ever said that ever in this type of field, but sure.
Exactly. So that was one of the surprises. No real firm release date on it yet, but just the fact it's in development. And I believe the trailer even acknowledged that it was just early engine in-game alpha footage, and there's still more work to be done, so probably a 2017 release, maybe 2018, but it's still a ways off yet, so expect to see it at E3 2017, which might be the E3 we see something from Nintendo about Mario, as we have one last quick news item to get to here. We saw what Nintendo did with their new take on the Legend of Zelda franchise, taking it in a completely different direction and really captivating people and giving it an entirely breath of fresh new air.
Yeah.
And it is through that lens that a comment made by Shigeru Miyamoto while talking to IGN is very interesting. It's a very brief quote, and we really don't often talk about these sorts of things, but again, through the lens of Legend of Zelda from E3, we'll share it with you. He was asked about a future Mario game from some reporters at IGN, and he said, quote, "We're always challenging ourselves to create something new, so hopefully you'll see a new kind of Mario game in about a year or two. Maybe next E3 we'll be able to share something," end quote. New kind. Not a new Mario game, just a new kind of Mario game.
Yeah. He went on to also kind of explain that it might be, like, it's a difficult task because, I quote, "It's kind of difficult with Mario because some of the more important conventions of Mario are based on the approachability and accessibility of those games." He said that he noted that having new people join Nintendo has also allowed them to look at the conventions, and I quote, "with fresh eyes," which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, if you look back, even back to Super Mario Brothers on the original Nintendo system, it was brilliant in many different ways because it sort of introduced gameplay elements to you without having to hold your hand. And it's always a very interesting thing to, you know, as to see, like, that you don't realize that you're learning, but they're teaching you very subtly about different things. I mean, it's, you know, in the age where we just kind of see, like, you know, very blatant tutorials where, like, you're playing and then you'll stop and be like, "press X to blah." And it's just like, well, that takes me right out of the game. As opposed to looking back at some of these classic games that just did it gradually, where it's just like, they'll introduce, like, if I think Mega Man X is another good example, that there's actually a whole analytic video where someone's showing you about how Mega Man X, the intro level, is the perfect tutorial that doesn't feel like a tutorial, shows you all the different elements that you need to know about the game without telling you everything. Like, you have to figure things out on your own, but it gives you just enough to be able to sort of start getting through the game.
Mm-hmm.
The original Super Mario Brothers game did that, and it was very approachable. I mean, anyone could pick up and play that game.
Certainly.
I mean, there were two buttons, but, like, you know, there was very, it's like, you different ways of jumping and stuff, and, like, little subtleties that you could eventually dig into, but right from the start, it's just pretty basic, like, run, jump, you get this thing, you get bigger, you can do a couple of other extra things, you get this other thing, and you can shoot fire flowers, or you can shoot fireballs out of your hand, kind of thing, like, oh, it's kind of cool, like, it's pretty easy,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, be interesting to see what they do, though, because, I mean, we've already seen Mario kind of be reinvented in several different ways.
True. I mean, after the 2D era of platforming, then we got the 3D open worldness of Mario 64.
Yeah.
And then we got
moving that further with Mario Galaxy.
Yes, where you're not just moving around in open, you know, land, you're moving around in open galaxy.
Yeah, and we have seen other interesting, you know, gameplay elements introduced and removed and sort of like swapped in and out, you know, like Metal Mario or in Super Mario Sunshine, the
water pack.
That water pack machine thing. And, you know, underappreciated game too. I enjoyed it. But yeah, it'd be very interesting to see what they mean by this new type of Mario.
And again, this is through the lens of Miyamoto saying at E3 2016, where we saw what a new take on Legend of Zelda meant.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think they're going to do huge open world.
No.
Like Breath of the Wild for Mario. That would not make sense.
No, it's like, new legend, it's like we're gonna redefine what Mario means and turn it into Zelda? Is that what that means? Weird. No, I don't think that would be appropriate.
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Mario.
Grand Theft Mario, exactly. You know, he's gotta steal cars, drive around the Mushroom Kingdom.
Keep his star level down.
Keep, or keeps it up and that's how he becomes invincible.
Yes. Yes. That's where it's revealed that the stars are actually PCP.
Ooh, Toad's actually his dealer. And Bowser is just a rival gang lord.
Yep.
Who just keeps stealing, you know, Princess Peach.
It's like watching The Wire.
Luigi's in jail.
Doing a bid, as they say.
Sure.
Yes.
So. So again, just an interesting quote from Miyamoto. We don't often share those sorts of things that, you know, an executive will say because quite often there's nothing really substantive to it. But, what would a new take on Mario mean? We don't quite know at this point. But again, keep in mind that Nintendo is building, and working on a new Mario game because they'll need one for when they launch Nintendo NX. I mean, you always need to have a Mario game on a new Nintendo system. It works as a system seller because people just will want to play a Mario game.
It's true.
That goes without saying. So how it will break down, how it will all shape up, and what these new young, fresh eyes at Nintendo have to say and what they've seen about the standard conventions and how that can be reinvented, we'll see. But again, based off what they did with Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, I'm intrigued. They clearly have some good ideas going on.
Yeah, I think so too.
But that is for E3s of the future. I believe we've put a nice little bow on E3 2016.
Yep, I think so.
But before we end off this week's show, we have to leave you with a segment that we always have at the end of every show where we like to encourage you, remind you, point out some things that are old but still worth checking out and or trying. It's our Blast from the Past segment, and we have two items of this week. One you listen to, one you watch. One is very old, the other half as old.
Yes, the half as old one, maybe we'll start with that one because it's a little bit lighter, and well, half as old is kind of relative because it's still pretty old. This thing came out 25 years ago in 1991, on June 28th to be precise.
Indeed.
This was a movie that I think both of us enjoy greatly and have seen many times in our youths and whatnot growing up.
Certainly.
This was the second of the Naked Gun series, which was called Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear. Which, of course, the Naked Gun series was like hilariously named like that, the third one being 33 and a third.
The Final Insult. The
Final Insult, and the first one just being The Naked Gun.
From the Files of Police Squad. From the Files
of Police Squad, yes.
Because actually the whole Naked Gun movie franchise was based on a short-lived TV series.
Yes, yeah, called Police Squad.
Yes, that was done by Zucker and Abrams and, Abrahams, and had Leslie Nielsen starring as Frank Drebin in that show. Got canceled, and then somehow reborn as a movie franchise.
A successful movie franchise.
With Leslie Nielsen returning as Lieutenant Frank Drebin.
Yep. But yeah, I think probably the most memorable for me movie in the whole series was 2.5, The Smell of Fear. The one I've seen probably the most out of the whole series.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious movie if you've never seen it. I would definitely recommend it. It was done by, you know, Zucker and Abrahams, I should say, the same, you know, or might have just been Jim Abrahams.
Both Zuckers are on it.
okay.
Zucker's and Abrahams. It's the classic comedy, you know, team that gave us Airplane as well. And Airplane, the sequel.
Yeah.
Which, they do good work.
They sure do.
If you've never seen Airplane or Airplane, the sequel, sweet God, just make it a whole Abraham Zucker, Leslie Nielsen weekend.
Yeah, there's enough movies to really keep you quite entertained all weekend. Going from Airplane to Top Secret to all the Naked Gun movies to even like some of the later Scary Movies.
Was it Scary Movie 3 or 4 they did?
I think it was. And it had the same kind of classic type humor.
Where it's just a spoof.
Yeah, everything is a spoof, but some of the most brilliant, silly visual gags you'll see in any sort of movie.
This one in particular, the plot of it focusing on Leslie Nielsen and his character is Frank Drebin, who has to protect and rescue, I believe, Dr. Mannheim, who is a leading professor on clean energy, and his recommendations will just, you know, set forth the energy policy for the United States of America. But then Robert Goulet, as the evil tycoon of the movie, captures Dr. Mannheim and replaces him with an evil doppelganger.
I mean, Robert Goulet really stretching his comedic chops in this film as well. Robert Goulet was hilarious in this movie.
Oh God, was he ever.
Like, you may not have really thought of Robert Goulet as like a comedic force up to that point, but he was great. This movie was hilarious.
It worked. It was well within his range. Also, Leslie Nielsen's in it.
Yeah.
Leslie Nielsen really at his comedic best.
Yeah.
Some of his comedic best.
Some of his comedic best, for sure. And a pre-crazy O.J. Simpson.
True. Very true.
Like, back when O.J. Simpson was actually really funny, too.
Before O.J. became known for bad things.
All of those bad things that he became known for, yes.
In 1994, and then that whole schlamozzle, and then, you know.
Then later on now, like, when he's sort of still facing weird problems.
Well, he's in jail in Las Vegas for, I believe, holding a man.
Aggravated robbery, I think it was.
Robbery? Assault?
Yeah.
Basically held him, like, basically kidnapped him and held him hostage in his own hotel room.
Yeah.
Until he got, like, certain merchandise back. Nevertheless, before O.J. lost his mind.
Yeah.
He was funny in this.
Yes, he was funny as hell in these movies. I mean.
You know, playing, you know, kind of the mindless sidekick, but the whole movie has mindless characters as well. But it still makes sense, and they all have, you know, good enough hearts that they're endearing to you. And also, just sight gags aplenty, snappy one-liners.
Yeah.
Weird Al makes a cameo.
Yeah, he's a thug at the police station.
Because when I think badass thug, I think Weird Al.
Yes, of course.
And of course, I mean, it's a Naked Gun movie, so it's got the classic Naked Gun intro of just the police, you know, light and siren on the top. Just,
yes, whereas like the car's driving through all sorts of places it shouldn't be driving through, causing calamity and chaos because Frank Drebin is one of those aloof cops that has no idea what he's doing and he's not aware of his body and he's just walking into silly things and doing things and ending up on stage at some award ceremony where people mistake him as Donahue. And he pukes in the tuba. There's all sorts of just classic stupid scenes in this movie. And all these movies, really. All the Naked Guns and all the Abraham Zucker movies, really.
Mm-hmm.
But
and I feel like the Naked Gun is, one, a franchise that's kind of slowly, steadily being lost to time. But two, it's also a really type of humor that we don't see all too often these days.
Yeah, it's just, it's hard to explain, but it's stuff that knows it's stupid, but it's smart as a result, if that makes any sense at all.
It's a very fine line for a movie to try and walk.
Yeah.
Between being stupid and smart. And
I mean, like, it was kind of like the conventions were sort of established by, like, Monty Python and people like that, Mel Brooks and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of continued on through like the 90s, but it seems like, yeah, like, I don't know if we see comedies like this anymore that are just off the wall stupid, but know they're off the wall stupid and so brilliant in how they are off the wall stupid, like very calculated in several ways.
Mm-hmm. as opposed to going too far with it.
Yeah, like just like, and, like putting a hat on a hat kind of thing too much, or like killing a joke with a joke that's not needed after or whatnot. Like this one, these movies knew exactly when to pull back and then when to hit you with something else ridiculous.
There are scenes with Leslie Nielsen as Frank Drebin in this movie and Barbara Bush. It does not go well for the Bushes, because this came out in 1991 when George Bush, Papa Bush, the first Bush, was president. So, yes. It's not actually them, it's just actors made to look like them and play them. But also Priscilla Presley.
Yeah?
Not a name you hear too often these days. So really, this is kind of a movie very much from a bygone era. Sadly, Leslie Nielsen has passed. Sadly, Robert Goulet has passed. Priscilla Presley, no longer as much in the, you know, Hollywood mainstream entertainment eye as she was. George Kennedy, I believe, has also passed. O.J. Simpson is batshit crazy.
Robert Goulet, yep, just
and is so in prison. People. So, you know, kind of depressed now as I go through the list, but makes me want to watch this movie all the more.
Yeah, classic movie. So, Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear.
But when you're driving around to try and find an actual physical copy of Naked Gun 2.5 to watch, you'll need something to listen to, because FM radio just may not be your bag. And for that, we have you covered as well with an album that, as I said off the top of this segment, was very old, because it came out on June 27th, 1966.
Yes, celebrating its 50th anniversary, in many ways doesn't sound 50 years old, because it was, by many accounts, way ahead of its time, because the man responsible was way ahead of his time, and was kind of eschewing all of the conventions of the time, and continued to do so throughout his entire career, which numbered in, what, over 80 albums?
I've lost count. And how many of them were posthumous releases as well?
And how many will still be posthumous releases, because there is unreleased material to be heard still. The man we're speaking of is Frank Zappa, and the album we're speaking of is the debut album by Frank Zappa with his Mothers of Invention. The album is called Freak Out.
Now, you may have heard us talk about this album previously when discussing Frank Zappa, and maybe points of entry for listeners or just people out there who want to get into Frank Zappa but don't know where to start, because the width and breadth and the volume of content in his discography is overwhelming. How do you pick out an album to start? Sometimes the most logical place is the best place to start, and that is with Freak Out.
But sometimes you might argue against that, because Freak Out in and of itself is such a strange oddity, just based on when it was released. The fact that it was the debut album, it's super weird that it was a double album, first of all.
Yes, one of the very first double albums.
Yes, I mean, Bob Dylan released a double album that called Blonde on Blonde that preceded by a week. But that wasn't his debut album.
That's true.
Freak Out is the debut album, and it was a double album. And it was the first album. Like, that's... Who does that? Whose first album is a double album?
That is ballsy.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's absolutely classic. I can still listen to it, and I can't find a bad song on it.
Yeah, I mean, It's a strange album because, I mean, it takes 60s culture and it basically snubs its nose at it while kind of tipping its hand tipping its hat sonically to 60s culture in many weird ways as well, while also sort of doing it, you know, in a, you know, like a winking at the camera kind of way by just being like, yeah, we get it. People like this type of music. See? Oh, we can do that too. But also, don't you feel stupid for liking this kind of thing? Like, really? This is what's popular? And that's the kind of weird thing about the album, where they're good songs, but you don't know why you like them, because they're sort of browbeating you into just saying, hey, you like the stupid thing, but here's a slightly better version of it. Wouldn't it be better if it was this? And it sort of set up a bunch of interesting motifs that were kind of continued on throughout the entire career of Frank Zappa, and as his son Dweezil points out in interviews now, it's sort of weird, but throughout Frank Zappa's entire discography, it's almost like it's one continuous piece, because if you listen to his music from the beginning and keep going, you will hear themes repeat sometimes 20 albums apart and go, hey, that's a callback to this. And there are callbacks, like plenty of callbacks to Freakout later on in the Frank Zappa canon, really, like melody-wise or theme-wise or just kind of like interlude-wise. Like there's lots of different things that were set up on this album that were kind of paid off later, but still, like, classic album, lots of songs will probably get stuck in your head. I mean, the top of my head, like, Who Are the Brain Police?
Oh, God.
Hungry Freak's Daddy, Colony Vegetable.
Well, it starts off, is not the lead track on this album, Any Way the Wind Blows?
It could have been. I think Hungry Freak's Daddy was the first one.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, there's...
But it's also got Any Way the Wind Blows, which is just a light, catchy, you know, 60s-styled pop song. Kind of in the vein of, like, say, a Beach Boys or other, you know, popular pop songs of that era. But then it also contrasts with a song like Who Are the Brain Police, which is a very alternative song for the era. Very much an underground kind of art culture type song as well.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, yeah, very, very interesting.
It's still immensely listenable.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, hard to say that you shouldn't check it out. In many ways, yeah, it's less weird, like, crazy musical virtuosity and more just catchy songs just to kind of get you hooked, which might be a better way of entering into the Frank Zappa pool without jumping right into the deep end.
You need certainly to progressively wade your way into the deep end, and this has, yeah, retains a lot of songs with traditional pop song stylings and formats and structures.
Yeah.
And then before he gets into some of his more out there compositions or even just jazz albums.
Yeah.
Because those are deep. Those are just going very deep.
They sure are.
And if you're new to Frank Zappa, we suggest you avoid those to start with. You'll just steadily work your way up. You know,
yes, don't go right into like Civilization Phase 3 or The Man from Utopia or anything weird like that. No, don't jump into that. Maybe start with Freakout.
Yes, with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, a counterculture album, an alternative album before really there was an alt music scene. Frank Zappa really just blazed a trail for unique artistic styling sounds and music and just artistic presence.
Yeah.
That, you could get away with in the 60s that there's no way you could get away with now.
No. Absolutely not. you could get away with it now, but you couldn't get away with it and be as popular and successful as he was.
True, too. And for as long as he was as well.
Yeah.
So, also, again, double album as the debut album.
Back in the 60s, when they wouldn't just sign anyone.
Nope.
I mean, you had to actually work to get a record deal. You still do, but seemed like it was like almost something strange about it too, because like they didn't have home recording technology like we do now. Like,
oh no, you had to go through a studio. It was still an expensive proposition.
Yeah.
And he recorded a double album.
Yes.
That's a lot of money, even in the 60s.
It sure was.
Unlike now where, you know, a lot of, there's home recording technology, studios, desktop, music workstations on.
Yeah, for a couple of grand, you can just get yourself set up with a pretty decent recording setup.
You certainly can, but nope, not back then. And to just really hear kind of the start of Frank Zappa's career and maybe use that as an entryway into learning more and discovering more of Frank Zappa's music, which we certainly encourage you to do.
Absolutely.
Appreciated musical genius in this day and age. Go check out Freak Out from Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And hell, while you're at it, enjoying underappreciated geniuses, check out and watch The Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, starring Leslie Nielsen. Canadian comedic icon, Leslie Nielsen.
Yes.
Who sadly passed away a number of years ago, but also Canadian Robert Goulet in there as well.
Yep.
The man with the golden pipes.
It's true. Can't really recommend the movie enough. It's classic.
So those are your blasts from the past for this week. Don't worry, you'll have some extra time to get at them because, an important programming note, we will not have a new episode for you on Friday, July 1st. Again, we're taking off Friday, July 1st because where we live, it's Canada Day and we will be celebrating the birth of our country.
Yes.
And also, that's usually the post E3 lull when it's just everyone's tired from E3. They're finally going through their notes, showering, sleeping, eating not fast food based diets.
Yep.
And we'll be off, for, again, Canada Day. Also a couple days after that is 4th of July, when fireworks are plenty and whatnot. So we'll be off for those occasions, enjoying summer, possibly getting tans, possibly staying inside, avoiding the sun entirely and just playing video games.
Yes. If you're a vampire like me, whose skin is milky white, who doesn't tan but burns and goes back to being white, you need some SPF, my friend, just like me.
You sure do, but instead of having a new episode next week, we'll have a brand new episode Friday, July 8th. Again, nothing on July 1st. We're taking it off. Holiday where we live. Hopefully there's a holiday where you live as well. If not, make it a holiday. You have our right to declare it as a religious holiday. Our permission. Go. There you have it.
Indeed.
But again, new episode Friday, July 8th. In the meantime, you can check out all as many shows as we can muster in the archives on our website, thearcadeshow.com, or on our iTunes page. While you're there, subscribe to us, give us a rating, leave us a review, all that kind business. Go to iTunes, the podcast section, search up The Arcade, and we'll be one of the first results. Video game podcast, bright yellow and green, image. Can't miss us.
Yep.
Can't miss us. Or what else you can do is just if you get lost and you totally forgot all those things I told you, you can email us info@thearcadeshow.com. Drop us a line using the contact us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. We are on Twitter. You can reach out to us there. We are at The Arcade Show, or you can also reach out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. So until 2 weeks hence, Friday, July 8th, we'll see you then. Good night, everybody.
Good night.